Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The great 17th century Dutch philosopher Spinoza famously made the case that the human mind, emotions, and body were not separate, but one. He lost that debate 300 years ago. Now, acclaimed neuroscientist Antonio Damasio says Spinoza was right. Our emotions and feelings are as biological as our livers and toes, and a lot more exalted in their roles tonight on Point, the new biology of emotions and feelings as the ultimate key to life. We begin in Liberia, where, despite announcing a ceasefire, rebel soldiers today continued their shelling of the capital of Monrovia. The Liberian officials put yesterday's death toll at over 600. Tom Masland is Africa regional editor for Newsweek magazine, reporting from Monrovia. I asked him to describe the scene in the capital today.
It's a little bit quieter than it was yesterday. There's combat going on at one side of the central city. But it was quiet enough for President Charles Taylor to bury his mother, something he's been wanting to do for the last month.
Is there any sign that foreign peacekeeping troops are any closer to being deployed in Liberia?
Yes. There have been reports of a deal by leaders of West African countries gathered under ECOWAS. There's some 750 Nigerians, a battalion, ready to move out. But it's unclear whether it will actually be in the next few days, as some people now are suggesting.
Do Liberians now expect that these West African forces might come in to try and keep the peace if American forces do not? Would the Africans come without American presence?
Well, I think it's pretty clear by now that a deal has been cooked for at least an American support role, logistics, and so on, in a peacekeeping operation here that would then turn into a UN operation similar to what's going on in Sierra Leone. Whether there'll be American combat troops here, that's still very much up in the air, although there are reports of a unit of several thousand American troops being shifted to the Mediterranean region, possibly in preparation for their deployment down here.
What is the scene around the American embassy today? Yesterday, we saw photographs of bodies piled there, U.S. Marines kind of facing down crowds outside. How about today?
A mortar shell did land quite near the embassy again. I'm not sure whether it caused any deaths or injuries, but there's a big empty area, U.S. embassy compound, that's become a kind of displaced persons camp where Liberians huddle to try to take refuge in times of crisis, and somebody is dropping mortar shells in that area. It happened the last time there was a lurid offensive, and it's happening again.
And what about the fighting on the outskirts of Monrovia? Is that going on with intensity today?
Yes, it's continued to be quite strong. Neither side seems to have the upper hand. In the area of the port, the rebels have gotten a foothold, but they've been unable to cross either of the two main bridges that connect that area to downtown. So there's a confrontation essentially across a narrow, about a couple hundred yard body of water with a couple long bridges across it, a lagoon. The downtown is kind of a peninsula with a raised area at the tip that's very easy to defend. So geography has a lot to do with what's happening here in terms of the war, because it's one thing to take the countryside, but it's quite another to actually capture the capital.
So when you speak with Liberians in Monrovia at this point, do they seem to assume that the guerrilla forces will ultimately prevail, that Charles Taylor will be ousted, or is that still an open question?
No, I believe everyone accepts that Charles Taylor has been defeated and realizes that he's taken the practical step accepting exile as the best of his alternatives. But the question of whether the rebels are strong enough to take the city is very much an unknown, even to people who live here and have lived here for a long time. When Charles Taylor took power, there was a fight for the city. And for months, the city was divided into sectors. Charles Taylor's movement actually split. So there are at times three different parties vying for the Capitol. I don't think that the consensus view is that this current offensive will necessarily end up in a total victory for the rebels. But people have seen so much around here over the last 10 years that they just say anything can happen.
But the fighting goes on, Tom Maslin. So at this point, what are the international forces, including the United States, in whatever role it might play, what are they waiting for?
It's hard to say. President Bush may not have wanted to commit to an African peacekeeping operation under duress and while he was in Africa. I think you could interpret the decision to deploy a fact-finding team 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, the White House way of deflecting the decision while President Bush was traveling in Africa. You can either interpret that as a good faith effort to make sure that all the different ways that it could go wrong have been studied after our last bitter experience in Africa and Somalia changed the whole complexion of the Clinton administration's view toward international peacekeeping operations. Or you could say it was just a way to stall, because what better is there than to appoint a committee?
And so Liberia waits. Tom Maslin, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tom Maslin is Africa Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from Monrovia. In the 17th century, the remarkable Dutch philosopher Spinoza made a perilous career arguing that it is feeling and emotion that underpin our humanity, that the products of the human mind were not separate from the human body. Today, acclaimed neuroscientist and author Antonio Damasio has picked up with new science where the Dutch philosopher left off centuries ago. In his new book, Looking for Spinoza, Damasio says it is feelings in all their biological glory that are the cornerstone of human survival and well-being, that it is joy and sorrow that powerfully direct and define us as Homo sapiens. And unlike Spinoza, Damasio has the research to back up his argument. Did you think your feelings were just inconsequential background noise to life? Are you ready to see your most intimate feelings as a powerful outcome of evolution and biology, as key to your survival? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Iowa City, Iowa, is Antonio Damasio. He is head of the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa Medical Center and author of Descartes' Error and the Feeling of What Happens, about the neurobiology of feeling and emotion. His new book is Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. Good evening and welcome, Antonio Damasio.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, what a book, what a thesis, what a pleasure to dive in and get a glimpse of your world. So much I want to ask you about tonight, Antonio Damasio, but maybe the place to start off is the feeling brain. What are you talking about there?
Well, I'm really talking about the conditions and the structures of the human brain that allow us to not only have emotions, but to feel our emotions. And talking about the fact that now, with a variety of new techniques and approaches to the study of the human brain, we can, in fact, begin to understand what is going on in the brain when we emote, when we feel.
There is a tradition of thinking that goes back centuries, as you describe in Looking for Spinoza, and that I think willy-nilly is still very much alive today, that separates the body and biology from emotions and feeling. What's the legacy or the history of that view in a nutshell, Antonio Damasio, and what is contemporary science telling us that might refute that distinction?
Right. Well, it's a very natural distinction. And, you know, without the kind of knowledge we have today, one should probably not blame our forerunners for thinking that mind and body, that feeling and body, are really very separate things, because they appear to be separate things. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that when we look at a body, our own or somebody else's, We can see something, we can define a limit, a beginning, an end, and a middle, and we can define what Descartes, another philosopher that is very important in this debate, called extension. However, when we try to look at our own minds, it's something that appears to be of a different nature. It's something that flows very quickly and that is very hard to pin down. And it is out of this disparity between what you can touch and feel and see, something that has weight and size, and what we cannot really size up and pick up and hold, that the distinction came and took a life of its own. I think what has happened is that right now, as we understand more and more about how the brain is involved in the processes of perceiving objects, memorizing objects, allowing us to reason, and allowing us to have emotions and move about, have language and so on, as we understand that it is, in fact, the brain that is controlling these processes and that the brain is part and parcel of our own body, we have a sense that, in fact, this wonderful thing that we call the mind and our emotions and our feelings are, in fact, a very complex product of this incredibly rich organization that is the organism, and that, of course, brings together brain and body and allows us to have this spectacular production that is called a mental event.
And these mental events, emotions or feelings, and you make a distinction that we'll come to, you're making the point that these are not kind of the disembodied products of visiting angels or a disembodied self, but a real kind of biological output. How does that work?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. One way that gives us a sense of how it works and how it has to be that way is that emotions, contrary to what one might think, are not a kind of luxury that you might or not have. They're actually phenomena that are very complex and that play a role, guess what, in our own survival and well-being. When we emote, we are having a reaction that is, in fact, organized for us by a long history of evolution. Mm. And that reaction aims directly or indirectly at our own survival and at our well-being. So when, for example, you have a reaction of fear, that reaction in itself is not going to give you great pleasure, not great well-being. However, it is very dramatically involved in promoting your survival by staying away from a danger or running away from a danger and making it. And so indirectly, it will lead to survival and it will lead to well-being.
And you're saying this is hardwired. I mean, my ear hears the squeal of brakes, the adrenaline surges in my body, my heart may race, and the emotion comes right along with that.
Exactly. And it has been wired, to use your term, for a very long time in evolution because we are not the only beings that have such reactions. In fact, you can find them all around us. Now, there is a very important distinction to make here is that although these reactions are wired into our nervous system and into our organism, of course, they are adapted to a certain degree and modified to a certain degree by our own individual experience. So, for example, although there are certain things that you and I will have fear to quite naturally, there are certain things that I may be in fear of that you may not and vice versa because you and I have individual histories of development. We are quite unique as persons. Mm. We have not had exactly the same kind of events in our life. And because of that, some of our reactions, more precisely some of the objects, the stimuli that cause our emotional reactions are going to be different to some degree for every one of us. And that's why it's very important to make quite clear that although we have this huge inheritance from evolution, it doesn't mean that all of us react the same way. We do sometimes, we don't in other circumstances.
Mm. Antonio Damasio, stand by. We have to take a short break. It's a fascinating thesis. And when we go from emotions into feelings with all their subtlety, well, we're going to paint the biological line that connects all of that. We're talking tonight about the new neuroscience of feelings and emotions as key to human survival. My guest is Antonio Damasio, neuroscientist, author of the new book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. Did you think feelings were just inconsequential background noise, can you imagine feelings and emotions as the highest functions of the human body? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new neuroscience of feelings and emotions as key to human survival. My guest tonight is Antonio Damasio. He joins us from Iowa City. He's author of the new book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. He's also head of the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa Medical Center. He brings a almost unique confluence of medical insight, kind of philosophical insight, tonight through the alchemy of Spinoza brought into our contemporary conversation, and a literary touch that's pretty great as well. You can join this conversation. Do you feel diminished by a biological explanation for your innermost feelings, or do you feel empowered? Do you believe that biology determines your emotions and feelings, or does that sound too mechanistic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Antonio Damasio, I want to get very quickly to the consequences of this insight. But before we go there, I have to take it beyond emotion. And we were talking about an emotion or a response of fear that anyone can respond to and that we can almost feel viscerally how it's attached to the body and adrenaline and all the rest. But right. When you get into the realm of feelings, I mean, this is so famously subtle and complex and intricate. Marcel Proust and all the rest, you can follow feelings, infinitely. Describe how biology comes into play in producing the amazing complexity of human feeling.
Yeah. Well, there's one very important secret here, is that the reason why we have the possibility of feeling, which is indeed, as you say, quite extraordinary, is that we have in our own brains at any time the possibility of mapping our own body, and in fact mapping our own mind as well. So
mapping, do you mean consciousness by that, or what do you mean by mapping?
No, I mean mapping in the strict sense of the term, the possibility of making a map of, a representation of. So there are components in our brain, for example, in the region called the brainstem, mm-hmm. the hypothalamus, and also in the cerebral cortex, where you have literally regions of the nervous system that are, as it were, looking at different parts of the body, looking at the state of the chemistries in our body, looking at the way viscera such as the heart or the gut or our respiratory system are working.
Okay, kind of monitoring going on.
Monitoring constantly. In fact, I like your word monitoring, because there's sort of a super control set of panels that are looking at all the bodily functions, our muscles, our viscera, the chemistries, and so on.
So how does all of that get me feeling something, let's say ambivalence about some interaction I've just witnessed between two friends or colleagues? What's the connection?
Right. What it does get you is the possibility of knowing, the possibility of taking stock, mentally speaking, mm-hmm. of what has just happened in your body in connection with a particular object that caused the reaction. So you can put it in, imagine it as a sort of cycle. You begin, you just talked about your example, say mm-hmm. two friends that are having a fight, mm-hmm. and you're witnessing that conflict. That conflict, for a variety of reasons, produces an emotion in you that generates a change in the way your body is at a given moment. And all of those changes are going to be mapped, going to be monitored, and therefore represented in your brain. And it is out of that representation of what has changed in your own body mm-hmm. that you are going to feel, and of course you're going to feel, in connection with what started the whole cycle moving, which was the conflict between your two friends. So feeling becomes the possibility of registering what is happening in your body as changed by a particular cause and in connection with a variety of ideas that you can elaborate in relation to that fact. But the very important point is that if you did not have the access to those maps of your own body, you would not know what is happening in you, and you would not have in fact, the possibility of knowing how you have been set to react, first by evolution, then by your own individual learning of what the universe is like.
You know well and write persuasively about how controversial this concept has been over the centuries. Yeah. You've got a wonderful kind of parallel to your biological revelations in the book Looking for Spinoza. You've got this sort of romance going on with the philosopher Spinoza. Take us back for a moment to why this perspective of mind and body as one was so controversial in his day, was rejected in his day. If you could take us back in a way that might illuminate why we still struggle with this idea.
Right. I think that people have, precisely because when we started, we pointed out that the two things, mind and body, to be more specific, seem to be so far apart that your one's first intuition, untutored intuition, that is that they are, in fact, different things. And then there's another part of the problem. One reason why one would tend to accept that they are, in fact, not only separate but unrelated, is that we hold, and I think quite naturally, that mind is so sophisticated, so dignified, so capable, so beautiful, in fact, in all the subtle nuances that it gives us of our own life and the life of others, that it's got to be something different, something perhaps immaterial, something that cannot be explained by anything as pedestrian as a brain working.
Even something holy, even the province of the divine.
Yes, but you know, the issue with the divine is that it's hard to conceive of anything more divine and more sophisticated and more dignified and more awesome than the incredible process of functioning of a biological system, including its own brain. The more one studies biology, the more one studies the intricate complexities of anything from DNA to the life of a single cell to the life of our organism with its trillions of cells, the more one realizes how awesome it is. And if you want to bring the divine into it, fine. The divine is right there in that complexity, in that magic, as it were, that allows life to be and have its arc.
But that brings us around to this kind of materialist view, or as you put it, the pantheist view that in Spinoza's day was part of what got his thinking rejected, did it not?
Well, yes, because in its day, the amount of evidence for the structure that would permit something like the mind was actually very minimal. In other words, you had very little of it. It made sense that it would be that way, and Spinoza certainly is one person that goes in that direction, and for that matter, Descartes too. But you simply did not have the evidence that was powerful enough to make people think that way. The other thing is that when you thought in what one calls material terms, one had a thought that was rather gross. When you thought material, you sort of looked at the muscles in your forearm, or the skin, or the bone. You did not have the subtlety that one has learned biology does have, which really goes to the microscopic level and to a dynamic that is, I mean, the only word to describe it is awesome. And it's when you get to understand the degree of complexity and the incredible activity that goes on at that microscopic level, which incidentally is not accessible to the naked eye, that you realize that you are in fact accessing it, but not through the naked eye. You're actually taking stock of it through your own mind. So in a way, mind and feeling itself is a revelation of that enormous complexity and that enormous beauty of biology. And with me, and I think that with many other people, it produces exactly the opposite effect. Rather than feeling that you lose your dignity by understanding the underpinnings of, say, a feeling, I think we gain in dignity. We gain in admiration for how it can come about.
Right. So, Antonio Damasio, you wrap mind and body together. You're more than prepared to see the beauty of that pairing.
Yeah.
But lead us now on into the significance of the role of emotions and feelings. You know well that feelings are often dismissed as kind of, oh, that's just you know, background.
Right.
You actually put them at the very top of what you physically portray as a tree of life. And you say these are among the most powerful elements of the human biological kit bag, mm-hmm. defining elements, elements that decide whether or not humans achieve a kind of grace in life or not. Fill that picture in.
Right. Well, it's I like kit bag, by the way. That's a very good term. The idea is this. If you did not have feelings, if you did not have the possibility of knowing what is going on when you react to others, when you react to a particular object, you would not have the possibility of knowing what in fact is good or bad for your own organism, what in fact is good or bad for the continuation of your own life. So at the very sort of lowest point, mm-hmm. feelings give you a purchase on how you're reacting and on how those reactions connect to the world around you. And of course, once you can grow in that knowledge, once you can make literally classes, categories of events that will lead to, say, joy or sorrow, once you realize how that joy or sorrow in yourself can be related to the joy or sorrow of others, you really have the underpinnings, you have the foundation to create knowledge about how you can run your own life into the world. And I think that's a very important beginning of what ends up being our own social conduct.
So here's where biology reaches out and becomes a building block of ethics.
Absolutely. And, we have interesting evidence for this. It's not only an interesting idea, but it's also an idea that has evidence because we know that when parts of the brain, when systems in the brain that are related to emotion suffer damage, for example, as a result of head injury or of a stroke, there are consequences that are not only for the emotional system. It's not just that the person has an impairment of emoting and feeling in a particular class of emotion, but the person also suffers impairments in terms of social conduct. There's certain social conventions that may not be observed, certain rules of ethics that may not be followed.
So ignore feelings, and not only can the individual suffer, but an entire society can suffer. And Tony DiMaggio, we have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I'd like to invite them in. Let me turn to Donna right now. Welcome, Donna. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just had one quick question, and I'll take the answer off the air. But I was curious about the effects on the body and biology as our, I would call it, repressive society encourages the suppression of emotion in both young and older males and females. In boys and men, they're not supposed to be afraid or show empathy or be nurturing or show that they've been hurt. And in girls and women, we're not supposed to show anger or pride.
Right.
And how does that affect the body? And I'll just take the answer off the air.
It's a great question, Donna. And Antonio DiMaggio, as you tie this into biology, it makes suppression of feelings seem somehow akin to binding feet.
Very good image. It's an excellent question because there are certain emotions that certain cultural requisites tend to suppress. The caller talked about empathy, and it's very interesting. You know, we have this natural emotion called compassion or sympathy, and the feeling of that emotion is, in fact, what we call empathy. Mm-hmm. Now, that is entirely natural. It is something that is present in human beings. It's present also in other species. And it is something that, as the caller mentions, can be suppressed by certain aspects of the culture, by certain educational requisites.
So if feelings are so great, why do societies conspire to suppress them? And what are the consequences when that happens?
Well, I mean, societies conspire to suppress them because they want to obtain certain results. In other words, there are certain things that emotions and feelings produce that society may not regard as ideal. It's something we do all the time with everything. So, you know, if you regard the possibility that a man shows compassion as something that should not be done because it may make him appear less masculine, then, you know, you're going to try to suppress that.
And the consequences for the individual, for the society, when that kind of suppression goes on?
Well, you know, it depends on the individual. You know, in some cases, maybe the consequences are not terrible. In some, maybe, because there will be a clash. And whenever there is a clash between what you want to do and what society allows you to do, you have the possibility of conflict. And conflict, sooner or later, comes out, curiously enough, not only as a mental conflict, but as a body conflict. Mm. Because this will be interesting for your listeners. One of the great consequences of understanding mind and body together is understanding how so-called conflicts in the mind have a repercussion in so-called physical diseases and vice versa, because the two are so together that if you, for example, have a conflict such as the one the caller mentioned, mm-hmm. you may end up with signs of stress and signs, you may get an ulcer, for
this
example.
This goes to the well-being thing. One wonders if that couldn't be projected all the way out to the society. Let's get one more call before the break. Derek's on the line. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, gentlemen, for having such a thoughtful discussion. My question is really about intuition. I mean, we have such vague feelings that we're taught really to trust. And I mean, I know from my own experience that my intuition is usually right, but I really have no idea where it comes from, especially given that my memory is so often wrong.
Great, great, great question. Let us go to it. Intuition, is this biology's radar? Should Derek trust his intuition?
Well, first of all, intuition is, in effect, an emotion and a feeling. So when you intuit, you have an emotion and you feel that emotion, and it is that feeling that you have that is going to bias you towards a certain solution to a problem, for example. The important issue is that you cannot always trust intuition because you literally need to cultivate your intuition in order to produce the results you want. For example, scientists and artists cultivate their intuitions, and if they're lucky, they get good results, but it does not come naturally. In other words, not every natural emotion and feeling that leads to an intuition is going to lead you to a good result. Mm-hmm. Why? Because circumstances vary, and circumstances have varied in evolution. We're not the same human beings that we were 100,000 years ago, and we're not even the same human beings that we were 10 years ago. And as the circumstances change, we need to constantly make determinations as to what or to which conditions, which stimuli ought to be allowed to produce emotions and feeling in ourselves, and which ones we should try to avoid. So it's really a very active process, as, by the way, Spinoza had suggested.
So, Derek, you're going to have to watch that intuition and its success ratio. We're talking tonight with Antonio Damasio, author of the new book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine feelings and emotions as the highest functions of the human body, and maybe joy as the highest feeling of all? We'll come back and talk about that. Is it possible that joy is the ultimate human body function? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with acclaimed neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, head of the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa Medical Center, about his new book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain, about the new neuroscience of feelings and emotions. You can join the conversation. Do you want science to understand your most intimate feelings? And what happens when we unlock these mysteries? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Kurt is on the line. Hi, Kurt. You're on the air.
Oh, good evening, Dr. Damasio and Tom. I appreciate the delightful conversation.
Great.
I actually have some experience in working with this. I'm not a doctor, not a researcher, but I'm a blind clinician and have worked with duly diagnosed patients.
Duly diagnosed meaning?
Meaning that people who suffer both from a psychiatric illness and from chemical dependency.
All right.
And it was fascinating. It came from kind of a theory based on regular social interaction, the expectation in our greetings to one another on a daily basis is, oh, hi, how are you? And the response is supposed to be, oh, I'm fine, how are you?
Of course,
kind
yeah.
of a denial of emotions right from the get-go. People don't have anything to deal with anyway and don't want to hear what's going on with you.
Or an economical way of skipping the whole emotional
exactly.
field, yeah.
So
all right.
in working with these patients, come to find that their behaviors, their reactions to their emotions were basically having been blindsided by their emotions and gotten into patterns of behavior to either cover up or sedate or change their feeling state, feelings in their body through use of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they were dealing with a psychiatric illness and were self-medicating for that, or were in situations, you know, what came first, the chemical dependency or the psychiatric illness.
So you helped them identify the underlying emotions?
It was fantastic. I had this sheet that had very simple line drawings that showed facial expressions and then attributed an emotion to that facial expression and had patients look at this sheet every time we met in groups
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, what are you feeling right now? And had them identify both what the feeling was and where they felt it in their body, and had them determine when you had felt that before, what was your reaction to that?
And out of that, they became less self-destructive.
Well, having them identify what their behavioral reaction was to an emotion helped them to better understand what their patterns of behavior had done to them to get them into the hospital.
Antonio Damasio, let me put Kurt's story to you. I mean, we can all understand this as a kind of what we typically think of as a psychological exercise. Now you're adding this other element for us, the biological piece of this. What do you make of the story?
Well, you know, the important comment is it always helps to know. It always helps to understand. The more enlightened we are about our own history, about our own conditions, the more likely it is that we will be able to deal successfully with our situation in the future. And what the caller was doing and probably is doing now is helping his patients realize how they came to react in certain ways, what caused those reactions. It goes a little bit to the answer I gave a while ago about the fact that not every object that causes emotions should be cultivated. We don't need to accept it the way it is. We can say no to certain objects that could cause emotions, whether they're pleasurable or not, because we know that the ultimate consequences are not good. But in order to do that, we need to be illuminated. We need to have this clarified. And we clarify it both by doing things such as the caller identified, which is a wonderful strategy, but also by understanding how it works inside our own organism. And that's where neuroscience and the understanding of this togetherness of body and mind come. And it's interesting that the caller mentioned the fact that he would ask the patients to say, where do you feel it in your body? Mm. Which is a very interesting question, a good one to ask, because that's exactly it. Emotions are felt differently. We engage different systems. It is, I mean, this is something that anybody that has experienced great joy or great sorrow can immediately realize, although it tends to be denied. You don't feel joy and sorrow the same way in your flesh. It's quite different. Mm. Why? Because what you are feeling is, in fact, the changes that occurred in your body, and they are remarkably different. It is one thing to be terrified, another to be in grief for the loss of a loved one, another to be in exultant joy. And they're all different in terms of your body structure.
Antonio Damasio, I want to follow that right on out in the short time we have remaining to the sort of ethereal realms that this goes to. We can all respond to how emotions react to the squeal of an oncoming car. Mm-hmm. But you take it far beyond that. You say that this emotion and feeling rooted in biology is, in some sense, we want to talk about well-being, is the key to not just dealing with fear or danger, but dealing with the very essence of what it is to be human, the human condition, that is, to be blessed with this kind of consciousness and memory that make us super aware of our mortality that make us understand the kind of tragic element of life. And you say, ultimately, it is feeling, in particular the feeling of joy, that evolution has left us with as a way of transcending the circumstances of our own biology and our own mortality.
Right. And you see, the interesting thing is that joy and its variants, you know, I'm using the term joy in a very broad sense, mm-hmm. all the way to ecstasy. Joy really corresponds to a state of great harmony, not only in your mind, but actually in your own body physiology. Joy corresponds in most instances, except, of course, if you would be under the influence of drugs, for example, which would be an exception, joy corresponds to a state of your physiology that is working very fluidly, with ease, without impediments. And most of the negative emotions, such as anger, fear, terror, all of that, are emotions where all of our physiology is, in fact, impeded. It does not flow easily and harmoniously. So, in a way, joy is sort of the great sign, you could call it a revelation in the sense of lifting the veil of what it is that the organism looks like when it's working in optimal conditions.
I love this line of thinking. I have to say I'm a great believer in it. But you write, we should seek joy by reason to decree, regardless of how foolish and unrealistic the quest may look, if we do not exist under oppression or in famine, and yet cannot convince ourselves how lucky we are to be alive, perhaps we are not trying hard enough. There's the word from the That's neurobiologist. Right.
We need to try hard.
Try hard as the project for salvation. And you take it one step further. You say there's a kind of, there's a social angle to this, even a global social angle, that emotions and feelings have been worked out of this whole biological stew over eons. You say the planet and human global society is still working out its kind of the global use of emotions and feelings to reach a homeostasis or a well-balanced global community.
Right. And it is, you know, there is, you know, I believe that in our organisms there is this tendency towards balance without which we don't survive. We survive only because we manage to balance our metabolism, we manage to balance the conditions in which life is possible in a living organism. And that's done very naturally thanks to evolution and our genome. We're not really checking every minute aspect of our physiology. We just have drives and motivations that lead us, for example, to drink and to eat so that we can maintain our metabolism and not die the next day. But beyond that, emotions and feelings have projected themselves into the culture, into society, and have led to the creation of enormously rich instruments to regulate our life. Laws, systems of justice, bodies, international bodies that allow for life to be better regulating among nations. And that's a project that is still going on. It's obviously still in the works.
And maybe the ultimate power of emotions and feelings. Antonio Damasio, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Antonio Damasio is head of the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa Medical School and author of the new book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, an elderly driver weighs in on the debate over whether states need to take older drivers off the road. This is On Point. When George Russell Weller sped through a packed farmer's market last week in Santa Monica, California, the 86-year-old driver apparently stomped on the gas pedal when he meant to hit the brake. His confusion lasted for nearly three city blocks, cost 10 people their lives, and injured dozens more. The accident has renewed the debate over whether states should be more proactive in determining when to stop the elderly from getting behind the wheel. The issue looms larger as the baby boom generation grows older. In this radio diary, Hyla Coleman, a children's book author and committed driver, maintains that it is elderly drivers' responsibility to monitor their own ability and society's job to help older folks get around.
Everyone around town knows me as the old lady with the red convertible. I don't mind. My red convertible, and before that, the black one, and earlier the station wagon, they are all part of my life. But as with other things and people, our relationship has changed. I've been thinking about this more since I read about the 86-year-old man who last week plowed his car into a farmer's market in California, killing 10 and injuring dozens. I was troubled by this accident, but I'm also saddened that it has led to a general criticism of elderly drivers. How many times have we heard people say, old people shouldn't be driving? They may be right. Of course, many people on the road shouldn't be there either. But since it's old people we're talking about, we should remember that they are not alike. The one thing I hope we do have in common is a sense of responsibility. We, more than teenagers, are responsible for what we do. No one knows better than the driver if he or she is quick, confident, and capable on the road. You know better than anyone if your eyes are fading, if you're having a little trouble reading. You know if your reactions are slow or if your spatial judgment is unreliable. But giving up a car means giving up a great hunk of independence and freedom of movement, especially since our public transportation system is inferior to that of some third world countries. That's why many older people are inclined to fool themselves and keep driving when they shouldn't. It's also why we need a safety net. I've always assumed that was the State Department of Motor Vehicles. So I was surprised when I went to get my license renewed a few weeks ago and no one paid any attention to my birth date, which was a long time ago. I'm in my 90s. No eye exam, no test of any kind. My new license is good for 4 years. I should live that long. I don't believe it should be that easy. Licensing rules for older people vary among the states. Some do not allow drivers over 70 to renew their license by mail or require that their vision and competence be tested every few years. But for the most part, it's come down to drivers being honest. Driving a car involves handling an awesome machine, wonderful and dangerous. Not only your life, but all the lives of others on the road are in your hands. You'd better be sure you can handle it. As the years have passed, I have limited my own driving in the same way I've cut back on other things. I don't play tennis anymore. I avoid walking up hills. I don't see people who bore me, nor feel obliged to get up early. In other words, I do things I'm comfortable doing. As a driver, that means I don't drive at night. I drive to my son's house because I can go on slow country roads that I am familiar with. I avoid highways, which I've never liked anyway. If I am tired or just don't feel like driving, I hire a driver. I'm not rich, but I'd rather spend my money on a driver than on pills for anxiety. For many people my age, just getting out for something as simple as an ice cream cone can make a big difference in your quality of life. If we can't get there on our own cards or afford to hire a driver, we need better public transportation or the help of younger people who don't mind the company of someone who's been around the block a couple of times.
Hyla Coleman is the author of books for young adults. She lives in Bridgewater, Connecticut. Her essay appeared on the opinion page of the New York Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.